So how does that help your position? She claims that she remembers specific incidents of sex abuse, penetration and non-penetration assault. And she also says that there were that she drank to the point of blacking out at times. How are those two mutually exclusive?
Well, I guess ultimately that's for the court to decide, but our argument about this is kind of two parts. One part is that she says that she was very intoxicated during the time that these alleged crimes were taking place, and
That's wait a minute. That's the part that I'd like you to quote from the record. You just said that she says that she was very intoxicated when these incidents occurred. And I think the implication you're making in your argument is that because she was so intoxicated, she can't recall or process information accurately,
correct.
as a matter, I suppose, of scientific or physiological incapacity to recall and recount. So that's what I'm looking for in the record, whether the record actually establishes support for that argument.
And my answer is transcript pages 166 and 191 to 192. That's as much of a record
Okay,
as we.
can you quote the language from that part of the transcript that you think is most supportive of your argument here?
She said that she would, quote, drink enough to get myself drunk, end quote, and that she would, quote, definitely remembered being blackout drunk before and getting, quote, super drunk, quote, all the time, end quote. And she said when she was asked what the effect of alcohol is on people, she said, and this is in the context of abuse taking place, allegedly abuse taking place while there's allegedly drinking. She said alcohol, quote, makes you a little bit out of control and like you don't process things as fast, end quote. That's on transcript page 166. So there are two parts.
I have one other follow-up. Was there expert testimony developing this theory that, as a matter of medical or physiological fact, a person under the influence of alcohol cannot accurately process having been sexually abused or recount specific circumstances of sexual abuse or other circumstances?
There is no such expert testimony, Judge Ross. So the other part of our argument about this is that
So
she.
just so we're clear, what would our holding be if we agree with you, and since there aren't any cases that stand for this proposition, I assume we'd publish the decision saying as a matter of law, certain circumstances render an intoxicated person's testimony necessarily incredible. So what would the statement of law be? What is the principle that you're asking us to apply and other district courts have to follow?
If you're too intoxicated to remember, then your testimony is inherently incredible. I think that would
Right,
be the.
but in this case, there's no evidence that she was too intoxicated to remember, since there's no expert testimony and she didn't testify that she was so intoxicated that she can't remember. So under these facts, what would the standard of law be?
Well, I think it requires some interpretation. So our argument is that basically, if she really drank as much as she said she did, then she wouldn't be able to remember, but she claims that she can remember, so her testimony is inherently incredible. That's our argument. So that would be the rule. So the other part of our argument about intoxication is that the appellant's wife, Kelly Johnston, said that she never saw the girls drinking shots or liquor. The only time they drank was to take one little taste on special occasions like New Year's Eve of what Mr. and Mrs. Johnston were drinking. And then the complainant's mother, Amy Brown, testified that she never saw any signs or symptoms indicating that the complainant had even consumed alcohol at appellant's house, much less coming home drunk.
How do these factual challenges stack up to the standard of review, which requires us to assume at this appellate level that the fact finder rejected every bit of evidence and testimony that conflicts with the testimony that establishes guilt. So in this case, don't we have to assume that the fact finder believed, weighed credibility, and believed the complainant's allegations about the drinking in your client's home, and necessarily disbelieved the testimony, any other testimony, including from your client and his wife?
Normally, that's what the standard of review is. Our argument is that, Judge Ross, that some things are just inherently incredible, and I'm sort of going through the two possibilities here is either she doesn't really remember what she claims, or she didn't really drink what she said she drank, maybe didn't drink at all, which is the other possibility, and all these other witnesses are saying they didn't see her drinking, they didn't see her drunk, they didn't see people giving her alcohol at the Johnston's home. So that's the second possible scenario. Of course, her testimony is the entire thing, the entire hinge on which this whole conviction rests. So if her testimony is not believed, then that's the whole case, basically. There are cases where the Minnesota Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals essentially found things to be inherently incredible, such as the cases cited in our brief, State versus Glough, State versus Langtow, State versus Huss. And so there is some precedent there. I see my time has expired.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you'd like to reply after the state's argument. Counsel for the state.
Good morning, and may it please the court, John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. This court should affirm because the evidence sufficiently supports the verdict. The district court did not abuse its discretion in admitting evidence, and the court did not abuse its discretion in sentencing. Regarding the sufficiency of the evidence, the argument that appellant makes is directly against the standard of review, which requires this court to assume the jury believed all of the state's witnesses and disbelieved all the evidence to the contrary. The attacks on the victim's credibility also run directly contrary to this standard of review. In fact, the victim's testimony alone can be sufficient to affirm. Here, the victim testified that this happened on multiple occasions, definitely more than 10. She estimated it could have been between 20 to 25 different occasions. And at pages 167, 68, 69, 70, the victim testifies about the abuses she suffered at the hands of the appellant. This testimony was corroborated by other evidence as well. The victim's younger sister testified about the drinking, which between the sister and the victim is contrary to what this stepmother said, which then says this court must assume that testimony, the jury believed the state's testimony.
Does the sister's testimony corroborate the extensive alcohol consumption that the complainant was asserting?
It certainly establishes, it corroborates the drinking. And the stepmother says there was no drinking happening except for special occasions. That is inherently, it must be assumed to be disbelieved by the jury here, because the sister says, no, they were drinking, and the victim says they were drinking. So between that is plenty of evidence to establish this drinking. There's not evidence in the record that shows she was blackout drunk, could not remember these incidents every single time that they happened. The testimony, in fact, she started doing the blackout drunk, at least my recollection is, that after the abuses started happening, she would go off to her room and drink until she would black out. But she did describe with some level of detail various times that these abuses occurred, both at trial and corroborated by the corner house interview, where she did remember suffering this abuse. Her disclosures to her sister, her mother, and her therapist further corroborate her testimony. So there's ample evidence in this record, especially given the standard of review, to affirm these verdicts. Regarding the conditional release, the state is not contending that that is an insignificant sentence. It is a significant sentence or condition of the sentence, but it was correctly imposed here. At the sentencing, the court sentenced first on count two, imposed a conditional release for 10 years, said he would have to register as a sex offender for the rest of his life. And this is at pages 22 and 23 of the sentencing transcript. Then as to count one, imposed a sentence, which is page 23, and said the conditional release is for the rest of the duration of his life, which is at page 25. This is completely consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Nodes, as well as this court's decision in Brown. Brown is distinguishable from this because there was no time gap between the two sentences. In fact, at the Brown sentencing, the court said you stand convicted of both of these crimes, so you're convicted today on both counts. And it's the sentence that you should be committed and then impose the lifetime conditional release. So unlike in Nodes, there was no temporal time in gap between the first sentence, the second sentence. And as a result, this is very different from the Brown decision.
Mr. Schmidt, is it your presumption based on the argument of appellant here that there's no dispute that these were separate behavioral incidents?
I believe they were separate behavioral incidents. I think the appellant is arguing they were not. At least that's my understanding of the argument, that they were the same course of conduct. But I don't think there can be a dispute given the victim's testimony that this happened over 10 times. The incidents of penetration were separate from the incidents of when the appellant grabbed her chest and grabbed her butt. So given the different testimony with the different pieces in time, I don't think there can be a dispute about same incident.
Did the judge, I understand that was the argument at sentencing, is it your understanding the judge implicitly agrees by sentencing as the judge did, but did not specifically rule otherwise that they were separate behavioral incidents?
I think that's correct, Judge. I think that in convicting on both counts, the judge had to have believed that there were different incidents of this abuse, and that is certainly supported in the transcript from the trial. If there are no other questions regarding sentencing or sufficiency, I'll briefly discuss the corner house evidence that the trial court properly admitted. The court did not abuse its discretion in admitting that for several reasons. One, the defense had already cross-examined the victim using her own statement, the corner house interview statement. And any inconsistencies in that, as the trial court ruled, would go to weight and not admissibility. But the corner house statement also bolstered the victim's credibility after the defense had challenged it. And there's no question the defense challenged the credibility. The only question is whether it bolstered that. And when you compare the statements made at the corner house interview compared to the statements made during testimony, they are reasonably consistent, which is the standard. The age, the penetration, whether it was wrong or weird, all of those are reasonably consistent. The disclosures with the friends, the sister, the drinking that she stated in the corner house interview compared to the testimony are reasonably consistent. And as this court has said in Bakken, even minor inconsistencies, if there were minor inconsistencies, if it doesn't affect any of the criminal charges, that would mean this court should affirm. And there's nothing in either of the corner house or the trial testimony in any of those that would be inconsistent that would affect the charges. There's certainly no dispute that of her age at the time or that she was under the age of the criminal element, and the rest of the elements of the crime would not be disputed. Unless this court has any further questions, the state will rest on its brief.
Doesn't appear so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Judge Ross. A couple of things that I wanted to say, just so the record is clear on what the complainant's sister testified to about alcohol on page 3 of our brief. We pointed out that the complainant's sister testified that she and the complainant only drank when the appellant or his wife, Kelly Johnston, allowed them to try their drinks, and she never saw complainant drunk at appellant's house. That's on transcript pages 250 to 51 and 253. So her testimony, the complainant's sister's testimony, is far different from the complainant's.
That really doesn't help your position much, at least as it regards the incapacity to perceive and recount assault.
That may be, Judge, but I just want to make it clear what the appellant's sister said. Now, on the issue of conditional release in Brown, this is what the trial court said in Brown. I have the Brown opinion in front of me, and the quote on it's star page 5, but the Northwest second page, I think, is 155. The quote of what the trial court said in sentencing that this court found in Brown was simultaneous convictions. This is exactly what the court said. The state just paraphrased it in its argument a few minutes ago, but it's important to note what the court actually said verbatim. Court said, you were convicted on June 22, 2018 of the crimes of criminal sexual conduct, and standing convicted of those crimes, so you're going to be convicted today on both counts. It is the sentence of law and the judgment of this court that as punishment, therefore, you shall be committed to the Commissioner of Corrections of this state for a period of 216 months on count 1 and 140 months on count 2. Count 2 will run concurrent with count 1. So, a lot of times in the law, I'd say people are a little bit confused on what actually counts as conviction. Like, you know, is a jury verdict, does that count as a conviction? Or when does a conviction actually take place? Is it not until sentencing? And so, in this case, Mr. Johnson's case, he was sentenced on count 2 and then sentenced on count 1. Well, it's a few seconds apart. But when you read verbatim what the trial court said in State versus Brown, well, he was sentenced a few seconds apart on the two separate counts. It's just that the trial court said, you're going to be convicted today on both counts. So I would say if that's a simultaneous conviction, then this Mr. Johnson's case is a simultaneous conviction also.
Mr. Keller, isn't it true the distinction in this case, though, the court entered convictions and sentences separately. So that would be the distinction from the Brown court?
Well, the problem is, Judge Sleater, you have to take apart a little bit what you just said, because you said the trial court in our case here entered convictions and sentences separately. They might have entered convictions separately if a conviction means I judge that you are convicted of this. I don't have the exact words in front of me of what our trial court said, but if conviction means imposing a sentence, then the trial court in this case did exactly what the trial court did in Brown. They pronounced two sentences right one after another. If our case is not the same as Brown, then it's a true elevation of form over substance. I don't think that's what the legislature or the Minnesota Supreme Court intended. As far as the corner house interview goes, I'll just say one thing about that because my time is about to expire. The state argues that the defense opened the door by cross-examining the complainant about her inconsistencies with the corner house statement. That's obviously true. They did cross-examine her, but then that's for the purposes of impeachment. So if the state then wanted to offer that when the defense is bringing it up, They're bringing it up for impeachment, not as substantive evidence, and the state offers it as substantive evidence. So that's a important distinction there. But I see my time has expired, so we'd ask that you reverse the convictions, find that the evidence was not sufficient, or if it was sufficient, that you reverse the convictions and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
And thank you both, Mr. Schmidt, Mr. Keller, for your arguments and for going through the process of learning how to use this technology and doing it well. We appreciate it. Thank you for your briefs and your oral argument today. The matter is now submitted under advisement. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you.
And with that, the court will be in a recess pending our next oral argument this morning.